The Guardian.
This is the Guardian Review Book Club with host Professor John Mullen. Last week, Zadie Smith came to the Guardian's headquarters in London's King's Place to discuss her latest novel about life in the capital, NW, which follows in the path of her first book, White Teeth. She began by reading from a chapter called In the Playground.
You can't smoke in a playground. It's obvious. Any half-civilised person ought to know that. Yes, agreed Natalie. Yes, of course. Is he still smoking? Asked the old white lady. Natalie leant forward on the bench. He was still smoking, about 18 years old. He was with two other kids, a white boy with terrible acne and a very pretty girl in a grey tracksuit and neon yellow Nike. The girl was doing what Natalie and her friends used to call lounging or plotting, i.e. she sat between the white boy's legs with her elbows on his knees in a lazy summertime embrace. And they looked quite nice together lounging on the roundabout, but it could not be denied the smoking boy was standing on the roundabout smoking. I'm going to give them all a piece of my mind, said the old white lady. They're all off that bloody estate. The old lady went over and at the same moment Naomi ran from the paddling pool into her mother's arms crying, towel, towel, towel. Natalie Blake wrapped a towel around her daughter and put plastic sandals on her feet. The old lady returned. Is he still smoking? He was very rude to me. Yes, said Natalie Blake, still smoking. Put it out, shouted the old lady. Natalie picked Naomi up in her arms and walked over to the roundabout. As she approached, a middle-aged woman, a formidable-looking Rasta in a giant Zulu hat, joined her. The two of them stood by the roundabout and the Rasta folded her arms across her chest. You need to put that out. This is a playground, said Natalie. Now, said the Rasta. You shouldn't even be in here. I heard how you spoke to that lady. That lady is your elder. You should be ashamed of yourself. Just put it out, said Natalie. My child is here, said Natalie, though she really did not have strong feelings about secondhand smoke, particularly when it was outside in the open air. Listen, if someone comes disrespecting me, said the boy, I'm going to tell him to get off my fucking case. Did she address me respectfully, though? Don't lie, because they all heard you. No, you didn't. You cannot smoke in a children's playground, shouted the old lady from the bench. Why does she have to get in my face in that manner? Inquired the boy. She has a right, insisted the Rasta woman. Just put it out, said Natalie. This is a playground. Listen, I don't do like you lot do round here. This ain't my manner. We don't do like you do here in Queen's Park. You can't really chat to me. I'm Hackney, so... This was an unwise move, rhetorically speaking. Even the lounging girl groaned. Oh, no, said the Rasta. No, you didn't. No, no, no. You're having a laugh. I'm Hackney. So, listen, you can try and mess with these people, but you can't mess with me, sunshine. I know you in a deep way, and I'm not Queen's Park, love. I'm Harlesden. Why would you talk about yourself in that way? Oh, you just pissed me off, boy. Why would you talk about your area in that way? I'm from Harlesden, certified youth worker, 20 years. I'm ashamed of you right now. You're the reason why we're where we are right now. Shame. Shame. Yeah, said the boy. And the girl laughed. You think this is funny? Said the Rasta. Keep laughing, my sister. Where do you think this leads? Said the Rasta to the girl. Me? But I ain't even involved. How am I even involved? Nowhere, said Natalie. Nowhere, nowhere, nowhere. Mummy, stop shouting, said Naomi. Natalie did not know why she was shouting. She began to fear she was making herself ridiculous. I feel sorry for you, really, said a previously uninvolved Indian man who now joined the circle of judgment. You're obviously very unhappy, dissatisfied young people. Oh, my days, don't you fucking start, cried the girl. The white boy she was lounging with looked at the gathering crowd and opened his eyes very wide. He started to laugh. You lot crease me up, he said. How did this even get, like, to this level? Asked the girl, laughing. I'm just sitting here chilling. How am I even involved? Marcus, man, you're bait. This is on you. Next thing I know, I'm on fucking Jeremy Kyle. Why are you laughing? Asked the old white woman, who now stood with the rest by the roundabout. I don't think this is very funny. Oh, man, this is long, said the girl. This one's back at it now. Old Mother Hubbard's on the fucking case again. This shit is crazy. All of this, asked Marcus, for a fag. Is it really worth it, though? Just sit down back where you was and calm yourselves. Go handle your business. Sit down, man. Fools, said the girl. Just put it out, man, said Natalie. She had not ended a sentence in man for quite some time. Oi, Marcus, said the girl. Just put that fag out, please. Shut this woman up. It's getting to be ridiculous now. You should be ashamed of yourself, said the old white lady. I was willing to chat with you, right, said the Rasta, adult to adult, and try and comprehend your point of view, but you lost me with that nonsense. Shame on you, brother. And the sad thing is, I've seen where it leads. Don't worry about me, said Marcus. I get paid. I do all right, said Marcus. Marcus popped his collar. His gesture was not convincing. I get paid. I do all right, repeated Natalie. Her lip was curled up in a snarl. I get paid, I do all right, she repeated. Yeah, sure you do. I'm a lawyer, mate. That's paid. That's really paid. These people are fucking mental, said the girl. If she'd come over and asked me respectfully, I would have just done it, argued Marcus. I'm actually an intelligent young man. But when someone don't respect me, then they're disrespecting to me, and then I'm going to step to them. If you had any real self-respect or self-esteem, argued Natalie, one person asking you to put a cigarette out in a fucking playground would not register as an attack on your precious little ego. A small crowd had gathered of other parents, concerned citizens. This last point of Natalie's was a great popular success, and she sensed her victory as surely as if a jury had gasped at a cache of photographs in her hand. Easing into triumph, she accidentally locked eyes with Marcus, briefly causing her to stutter. But soon she found a void above his right shoulder and addressed all further remarks to this vanishing point. Around them, the argument devolved into smaller disputes. The girl argued with the old lady. Her beau argued with the Rasta. Several people joined together with Natalie to keep yelling at poor Marcus, who by this point had finished his cigarette and looked utterly exhausted.
Dialogue's very important in the novel. Lots of the year you don't even live in London anymore. Do you think you've got the voices permanently in your head?
Well, I don't really try to keep up to date. I gave that up about a decade ago because in London things move too fast. Like when I was writing this book, I did phone my youngest brother and try to squeeze out of him some slang, but he just kind of laughed down the phone at me. I don't even understand what he's talking about half the time. So I try and get something which is as good as, no? Something which is believable. Because authenticity is kind of a fake in that way. If you think about something, example I always use is The Wire, where people felt that dialogue was so authentic, but I challenge you to go down to Baltimore and find anyone who speaks like those guys on the corner. I mean, they were speaking kind of Shakespearean street language. So it's not that it's like photorealism. It just seems to you as good as. It's a believable fiction. You know, I avoid what I can't do, but I like to write what comes to my ear one way or another. But I'm not really interested in like verisimilitude in that sense. I just want something that works rhythmically for me.
I suppose I wanted to ask you about the structure of it. It's in these five sections, and it's quite, you know, I suppose it's stylistically quite restive, I would say. Mm-hmm. Each one has its own style, different tense, different point of view, completely different structure. I mean, did you think of the structure first, or did it just come as an adaptation to the way it was going anyway?
No, the structure was always there. I always wanted to create the feeling of shock, moving from one section to another, the way you move through London neighbourhoods. That was a kind of deliberate choice. And then the Felix section, I never told anyone this before, but it's based on a simple heart. Have you ever read that? The Flaubert story.
Yeah, so that,
the incredible thing about that story.
The woman who falls in love with a parrot.
Yeah, she's just a... But the thing which always strikes me about that story is it's just a nice girl whose name is the same as Felix's. It means her happiness in the same way.
Yeah.
And there's nothing interesting about her, no? She's just a nice girl. And she lives and she dies. And it's incredibly hard to write something like that, no? I wanted to try and write someone who was just nice.
Yeah.
Felix is just nice. He's not fascinating, he's not particularly accomplished, but he's just a nice guy. And he dies at the end, as we all die at the end. So it was just a kind of test to myself to see if I could make someone like that. Because the instinct, when I think, when people sit down to write is to have drama, no? Or to think their character is someone who is in some way curious or overblown. And Felix is a perfectly normal person, a simple person, but I wanted to make you feel him and then feel sad that he was gone, because that's what Flaubert does so brilliantly. I couldn't do anything like Flaubert, but that was the plan.
But the first section is written in the complete... I mean, it's obviously it's from the point of view of Lear, but it's also written in just a completely different way. It's kind of stream of consciousness-ish, and there's kind of a bit of James Joyce there, and...
Yeah, I mean, I really wasn't thinking of Joyce at all when I was writing. I wrote the first page, like, 7 years ago, and it was exactly as it was, and it was just a tone. Like, when I'm writing, I'm just trying to get a colour of a certain kind, and that was the colour of that, and I kept going and I kept going. I wanted to try and write somebody in the middle of existence, someone who isn't quite formed, who isn't quite made, and that's how it came out. And then with Natalie, completely opposite, someone who is... thinks she knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
It's completely regimented in her existence and pursues it with a complete lethal monomania.
So in that first, the first part, the Lear part, I mean, it does seem also to have something to do with where we started, really, the sense of place, the Londonness of it. I mean, it does seem to be partly about just the experience. I mean, some of the most memorable bits of the first section are about the experience of going on a bus journey or just going down a street. And it feels like the momentariness of that is something... I mean, maybe you could do it just as well for the country. I don't know.
I'm sure you could. To me, it was just the feeling, particularly as I got older, of not feeling very well defined. I was really feeling like a collection of experiences. Like, you might learn that as a theoretical idea when you're 19 in college, as an idea of existentialism. Yeah. But as I get older anyway, I feel it as a reality. Like, you feel very unclear about what exactly you are, where exactly you're going, and what the point of the entire journey is. So for me, Lear was the most, I suppose, closely autobiographical, the closest to how I feel when I'm moving through the world, which is a little bit, I guess, lost sometimes. But the actual story of the Lear section came from a simple source. I was reading a Grazia magazine, quality publication, and it had, they have those, like, life story bits, which are clearly not written by real people, but by the editorial board collectively. And they're really interesting to me because they must be zeitgeisty. Like, the women sit around a table and think, what does a 24-year-old or a 28-year-old woman want to read today in Grazia about their life? And it was about 6 summers ago. It was a story about a woman who is happily married, whose husband desperately wants children, but she's secretly taking the pill. I just thought, what a curious story. And why would the Grazia women so sure that would be fascinating to their millions of readers? And the more I thought about it and the conversations I'd had with girls my age and older over and over the past decade, I saw exactly where they were coming from. It was a particular zeitgeist of they obviously having these conversations with their friends and anxiety about having children, when we're going to have children, should we have children, and they turned it into this neat little story. So I really thank Grazia for that inspiration, because it's truly brilliant. And something about it really got to me, because it was so devious. I mean, it's such a terrible thing to do to another person. At the same point, they thought of it as a perfectly reasonable story that millions of women in England would relate to. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's peculiar, and both your central female characters have these, as their friends would say, but I think as lots of readers would think, rather lovely husband to whom they both do rather devious, bad things, actually. And then they meet up in the last section of the novel to kind of, and the thing they'd most have in common in that last section is they've both done something rather deviously bad to these matchlessly attractive and pleasant...
Yes. Well, I guess it's a bit of a cynical view of friendship, but I have found in my experience that quite often we make bonds with people at the expense of other people, in our intimate lives and also in a larger social way. To get ahead, somebody else has to lose. That's kind of logic of the social lives we have. So I kind of wanted to play with that idea all the way through, both like in the city, in the social structure, and very intimately between friends. Mm. And also the idea, I don't think is completely untrue, that women have extremely intimate relations with each other, and as they get older, they become more intimate, and quite often over the heads of the men in their lives. The kind of joke comic version is that men, as they get married and age, have fewer and fewer friends till there's only that one friend who turns up regularly.
It's true.
Who you wish would leave. But the network of women expands, for various practical reasons, because they have children, because they spend more social times with their friends, and becomes more complicated. And I always admire books on that subject. Hilary Mantel wrote a wonderful book called Experiment in Love, which is about women's friendships, which is a truly brilliant novel, which I teach all the time in New York, and Margaret Atwood's Cat's Eye is another good example. So I was just interested in that mode of writing about women together.
Procreation is going on a lot in this novel, and Lear's very unusual in her neck of the woods.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, but a lot of the women I feel like I came up with, and maybe there's some in this room, have the feeling of absolutely wanting children and absolutely not wanting them at exactly the same moment. And that kind of schizophrenic mindset, I think, is more and more common, though. It's a kind of double lesson, partly to do with the way we were brought up. I was brought up a very strong feminist. I'm a very strong feminist myself. And children were kind of put on the back burner in various ways. But the idea of that double consciousness, to want something and to not want it exactly the same time, really interested me. Because state of mind that we elaborate on a lot in our fiction, in our films, but it's real.
I guess this novel is, and maybe it's a, dare I say, it's a sort of middle-aged novel in that it's about people who are old enough to have a past self, even if that past self was only 200 yards away. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Natalie has moved a little bit geographically, but a lot in other ways. So she's changed her name. She's even changed her first name. She becomes obsessed with this website for threesomes, and then she starts visiting addresses. Mm-hmm. You do plant quite a lot of clues until even a dullard like me gets what's happening.
Yes.
But you do it in such a way that it's not straightforward to realise for quite a while.
Well, my feeling about that was that people who do extreme things, like I'm always fascinated by murderers, for example, it's very, very hard for people who kill people to recognise the fact that they are bad people. It's really hard to take on as a personal identity the sense that you are the bad guy. People almost never do, no. They find some explanation or some defense of themselves. And also, I think what happens quite often is a split in the personality, no. You're doing this thing, but you're unaware of it. And we all profess to be amazed and horrified, but judging by, there was a European Union study recently of the figures of British people using pornography and phone lines and random sex on the internet. We're like the winners in Europe. We are the champions of this sport. So it's clearly not unknown to us. And I think one of the things, particularly about internet pornography and where it goes, is that people are able to split themselves. Like the father goes to look at internet pornography upstairs while his wife is asleep, then comes back down to make sure the kids are in bed, has in some way split himself. No, he's not putting the kid to bed thinking, I'm the guy who just looked at that thing upstairs in my office while pretending to do the bills or whatever. That's the story of everybody in England. That's what's happening all over, and we all know it's happening. But some part of us is able to separate, no, into the man who looks after his children and the man who looks at the pornography in the box room. It just would be my gut instinct that the more kind of Puritan and neat our lives have become, and certainly for my generation, I remember an article years ago when I was in college describing us as the new Victorians. We all got married, we had children, we bought our houses, and I have to feel like the Victorians, that it isn't all cupcakes and nicely cut lawns. Am I wrong, people? I think there are things going on. People have desires that aren't, you know, finished and completed in marriage, and life continues, and also life is long. So I wanted to try and write about that. But if you write about it with women, people get a little shocked. You know, I did some research. I went on Craigslist, and I was on Craigslist for about 30 seconds. It was so horrifying. If I put the stuff in Craigslist in the book, I don't think I could legal to publish it. So this is an incredibly watered-down version of what people are doing right now on Craigslist all over London, all over the world. So I really prettified it compared to what's going on.
And you do it via something you do throughout the novel in a way, which is that when people's actions or motives are mysterious, it's done by a location, isn't it? So each time it's a place, it's a really specific place, isn't
but
it?
But that was to me because her interest, I thought it was meant to be a kind of joke, is not really sexual. No, her interest is other people's houses.
Yes.
So that was kind of the joke, that her life has become more and more gentrified, and one of the things that it seemed to me about gentrified life is that it's incredibly lonely.
Yeah.
You start off with this mass of people if you grow up on a estate, and if you supposedly become successful, the great aim is to not talk to your neighbours. Is that the ideal? Or if you're really successful, to have a private jet where you don't see anybody if you fly from country to country or to your private island. It's like an idea that the good life is isolation. Yeah. I think Natalie finds that the good life, she doesn't know what it is, but maybe it's not there.
There's another kind of almost mischievous I think, example very late in the book of using a place where you're thinking of the place, but you can't quite work out what the people are doing in it, where Natalie and Nathan are going across this walk across sort of North London, and you get to a section called Hampstead Heath, and you're going through the directions like you're on a route finder. Yeah. You don't describe what they're doing, you just have their conversation.
No, because that was part of the reason for that is, if I were to do it in that very comforting third person, the thing about that third person is it's not neutral, no. That third person in the English novel has a certain class attached to it. And if I encased Nathan in that voice, I felt he would be like one of Dickens' working class characters, you know, perfectly nice, but kind of encased in this voice. So I really wanted him to be able to speak for himself and to make the reader... I didn't want to tell the reader how to feel about him. Just listen. Just listen to what he says and listen to what he does. And I'm not going to tell you that he has this background, his parents did this. And it's not, he's not being delivered to your for your delectation as, oh, here is the working class black man. What do you think? I wanted him to just exist. That's hard to do in prose. But the hardest thing when you're writing is to recognize that class, whatever class you happen to be in, is a total and complete bubble. It shapes your reality. It shapes your understanding of even the most basic things.
The murder that happens, the killing of, happens really early on.
Yeah.
And that actually, right at the end of the novel, you're a sort of a day or so on from where you were right at the beginning
exactly,
of the novel.
Yeah.
Felix dies on page 80 and then comes to life again shortly afterwards for his sort of section.
Well, that was another thing I wanted to do. If, you know, it's one thing to make you love a character and then he dies and then hopefully you're sad, but I wondered if I could make you sad while already knowing the ending, though, so not to rely on this thing of and then, which can sometimes be a bit manipulative. I just wanted you to be, to feel the sadness of this death. Because one of the things, and we've seen it with Trayvon this week in that extraordinary judgment, it's really easy for people to dismiss a young black man dying in the street. If you happen to be a young black man or related to young black men, every time they walk out the door you have this anxiety that someone's going to think that this person is disposable in one way or another, and then it's just going to be a little paragraph in the Evening Standard, black youth stabbed on, and that's your son, that's your brother, that's your uncle. So I was trying to make that anxiety real for people, and unfortunately I just think in our culture it's very hard for white female readers who do read so much of material that's published in this country to really take on that person and feel for them and understand them as a human. So Felix was an attempt to, like, imagine this person is a person. He's not just a paragraph in the Evening Standard. He had a life, he had a history, and now he's gone in 5 minutes for nothing. So that was really the intention. It was during the whole period I was writing the book, there was like a stabbing epidemic, it seemed to be going on in London.
So if anybody, and I try to keep my eyes roaming around everywhere, including the gallery, anybody wants to ask a question, oh, we've got somebody at the back already.
It was really interesting, the race of the characters, because whenever you're reading a book and you're trying to picture people, was that something you were conscious of, that any reader would be sort of checking themselves to see how much they were thinking about what race and what prejudices that gave?
A bit of that. You are aware as you're sitting down to write that just because you're in the minority in a country, that the moment you put the word down, this all kinds of meanings accrue to the word. But also, you know, mainly I just want to decenter a little bit the idea of white neutrality, that is the neutral race and all the rest of us are kind of variations on the theme. Because obviously we don't feel that way. We feel we are the centre and you guys are somewhere on the periphery. So the point is everybody feels that way about their own life. Now everybody feels that they are the star of their own life. And I really wanted to get that across in Felix, so he's not walking down the street thinking, I am a black man in a suburb of London. He thinks, I'm Felix and I rule. That's how everybody walks onto the street in London.
They kind of pigeonholed you and used the term multicultural writer and likened you to Rushdie, etc. And as you said, they don't always compare white middle-class authors like DeLillo and Franzen.
Yeah.
Tomorrow in London, there's a literary London conference on London literature, and lots of the academics are going to be talking about you and linking you to authors such as Foster Wallace and Pynchon and David Mitchell for an ethical kind of humanism or cosmopolitanism instead of multiculturalism.
You want to be a kind of Venn diagram of an author. No, I have lots of different interests, and I mean, the description of a human as multicultural is quite difficult. I'm bicultural. I am of two cultures. I'm not like United Nations or something. It's just Jamaica and England. The thing about comparisons to Rushdie, and I mean, we're just from completely different places, in every class-wise, race-wise, and every-wise, so it's just a bit odd.
Yes.
You get the feeling. And also, with Monica as well, Monica Ali, I really began to realise that they just mean brown. Like, because Monica is half Bengali. I mean, it's really, there is a big difference. So that's a bit surprising when you realise that that's how people, it's like it's news. You realise, oh, that's really how people think. It's kind of revealing. But, you know, you want to be read sympathetically with your sympathies, but my sympathies range all over the place.
I wondered sort of how you feel and whether you had any intent about what the reader would feel about London at the end of this book. And the other part I wanted to bring into that is that you sort of, Natalie's sense of, or rather the middle class's sense of, you know, raising yourself up and isolating yourself sort of from community, but the community that you paint within London isn't necessarily a positive one.
Somebody wrote to me very angry and said, you know, it was an American. I just watched the Olympics and everybody is really happy and London's a really happy place full of happy people and I don't know what this book is about. It's not about the London I know. I was like, oh, sorry. Now I was part of the tourist board. I mean, it's obvious that people want community, though. Like, even in the most upper middle class areas, the first thing they do after they've stripped away all elements of community is call it a village, get a local butcher's, and try and, like, recreate the village that doesn't exist. So it's clear that people do want to be near each other, whether they realise it or not, or want to be near each other in some kind of quite controlled way. I guess the problem people feel around gentrification is that people only want to be around the same kind of people. And that's problematic. And it's always really funny, like, if you're in North London hearing new arrivals say things, for instance, about the Muslim community, well, they stick to themselves, don't they? You think, they stick to themselves? Are you serious? So this sense of kind of, like, self-cloning and keeping together, to me, is a bit depressing, really. I do find that depressing. As to the communities you come from, I may be wrong in this, but my own personal feeling is that people who come from the kind of backgrounds I came from, at least, their main aim, some of them clearly do want to be middle class, but I feel quite strongly that people also want money for their own institutions, no? For their own schools, for the way their own communities, their own neighbourhoods. They don't necessarily want to live in a different, completely different way. They just want to support for the way they do live.
I haven't got a great deep literary question. I just really want to take the opportunity to say that when I first read White Teeth and then NW... it just really felt like one of the first books I ever read that actually had characters that I could identify with, that felt like they were part of my life. I grew up in London, immigrant parents, and since then there are far more novels like that. Did you feel you were quite groundbreaking at the time? Or?
No, I felt... I mean, I'd read Hanif Qureshi, right? His book came into my school, Bit of Suburbia, like contraband. I mean, it passed around the kids in our school. It's incredible. Like, we were passing around Freddy movies or whatever. But that book was so exciting to us. I kind of knew why, but I didn't really, you know, I was very high-minded and I wanted to, you know, write literature and not be bothered by what I thought of as identity politics or whatever. I wanted to try and survive and to write well and know I was writing well. But absolutely, when I read that book, I realised that it was possible, you know. I'd read a lot of the canon that had been put in front of us, but when I saw Hanif's story, and I mean, his is different. He's more suburban than I was, but I recognised bits, and also, of course, he's mixed race, and he was so funny, and it meant so much to the kids in my class, the people who read that book. It wasn't on the syllabus; we were reading Keats on the syllabus, who also meant a great deal to me. But to know that Hanif existed was a big, big deal. And then he wrote that great book set in Kilburn as well. Those things are really important. You need to know, and it's lovely. It's a satisfaction that a certain kind of reader has always had, like a solidly, you know, white English reader like my father could look back to Chaucer and say, oh, look, that man's just like me, or my grandfather was like that. And that's just one of the superficial... I think it is a superficial pleasure of reading, but it's a nice thing.
One of the things that I really liked about the book was the sense of dislocation that Natalie feels, which I think you capture really well. I mean, I have that sense of dislocation. What interested me, and which I don't understand about my own life as well, is what makes some kids from that kind of a background move. There's some dialogue where someone is saying, well, they just worked harder.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't seem...
It shocked me how many people believe that.
And it's not just the working harder because lots of people work hard.
I can only talk for myself, and I would say luck, honestly. Maybe I have an extreme point of view, but I feel like ability of any kind is luck anyway. So everything that I made of myself, whatever, came out from the ability to read smoothly and easily, which I always had from the youngest age. But I don't think of that as something that I earned, it just happened to be. It's like people who have a talent for music or a head for maths. So I don't think of talents as accruing to you as rights. I don't think of it that way. I don't think, oh, because you have a talent, you deserve to be this or that. You are taken out of your class, you get all the rewards. I don't think of existence like that. So that doesn't interest me, that picture of a meritocracy. And I've always felt uncomfortable with it, and until I met that young guy, Owen Jones, his name,
yeah.
I hadn't really articulated it to myself. He articulated it so much better that there's something kind of slightly obscene about the idea of you, like it's a talent show, you. You alone will be picked out of your class and shown as an example, like a kind of performing monkey. Look what can happen for you. And also it's just, if you've been in these schools particularly, you know it's technically wrong. Like in my school, I think two people go to Oxbridge a year, or used to, two or one. And there are other schools where a third of the school go to Oxbridge, for example. You may believe that a third of that school are just incredibly brilliant young men. Maybe they are. But I feel like in my school there are a lot of very brilliant people, a lot. And their talents went to waste for all kinds of complicated reasons that depress me, you know. Because I don't feel there was a great difference between me and them. There wasn't a great difference. I just got lucky. Met some people who were helpful when I was young, people who'd been to university, who knew about it, who advised my parents. A lot of it comes down to information, though. Like I think I've said before, but quite often in my area when I'm in a minicab, the cab drivers are always asking me about education. They want to know, what are the universities? Literally, what are they called? So then you realize that all of us in the middle class have a great advantage, you know, because we square the game, we know it already.
I was just thinking what you have said about Leah's story, because as devious and horrible a thing it is for her to have done, I think it's really interesting. I'm really interested in Leah as a character who is doing it for maybe a host of reasons she doesn't understand. And I was wondering if, you know, if you think it's kind of more about not wanting a child specifically or about kind of holding off the future.
I think it's about holding off the future, no, to a great extent. She literally wants to remain. There was a survey done recently asking people what their perfect age was, and apparently most people say 28, which is fascinating to me, because if you actually remember 28, you were unbelievably miserable for the whole of that year. So I think she has that sense, and also surprise, no, that time has passed. I don't think that's unusual in the way we live our lives in the West, that you're 20 and suddenly you're 30. It's like this incredible shock that all the time has passed. So I think it is about holding off what comes next. But I was doing some press in Italy a while ago, and a very angry young man, journalist, accused me of it. They said it was a metaphor, that I was trying to create a metaphor so the only people who don't procreate in the book are white. It was like a metaphor for immigration in Europe. It was extraordinary, like trying to kill off the entire race in a car. I was like, that is paranoid, man. That is a seriously paranoid reading of the book. But to me, it was just about a kind of desire for stillness, absolutely.
Well, that's a good place to end. Good last sentence. And so I just want to say, I want to thank you all for your questions and to apologise to anybody who didn't get the chance. But thanks very much for your swatting. On your behalf, I'm sure you'd like me to thank Zadie.
And thank you. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.